This episode contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes, which may be disturbing to some listeners.
Today we're bringing you part 5 of Missing in the Keys, the story of 16-year-old Cindy Gooding and 12-year-old Terry Alfonso, who went missing from Marathon, Florida in 1974. Our story continues as we search for answers. Are there still secrets left to be uncovered?
This is APB Cold Case. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
Here we are at part 5 of our story, a culmination of months of research and interviews. But what's interesting about this case is that the story kept evolving as each episode was released. Now, in case you missed it, there's a lot of information in the 4 previous episodes, which can be found on your favorite podcast platform, on our YouTube channel, and on our website, apbcoldcase.com, where we have detailed show notes, including a who's who, a timeline, and much more. All persons are presumed innocent. We're not alleging that any of the people we'll be talking about are official suspects or persons of interest. In the previous episode, we explored some of the most dangerous criminal predators this country's ever seen, several who were known to be in Florida when our girls disappeared. We looked at the outlaw motorcycle gang, two members in particular who escaped custody in proximity to Marathon, and during the time period in 1974 that coincides with the girls' disappearance. We talked about the disturbing confession made by Paul Crone detailing the murder of 2 teenage hitchhikers, but the details of his story kept changing. And we learned that serial killer Anthony Lorette murdered a woman in Marathon in 1976, just 2 years after Terry and Cindy vanished. But police have found no evidence linking any one of those people to this case. Cindy and Terry are gone, but there's no crime scene, no bodies, and we just don't know what really happened to them. As we dug deeper into this case, we were really surprised at the number of names that kept popping up, and we've told you about most of them. But then, during the production of this episode, a listener reached out to us with the name of someone he thought we should look into. He was talking about a former Marathon resident who had been implicated in the murder of a 15-year-old runaway in Florida in 1972, 2 years before Terry and Cindy went missing. This was a name we'd never heard before. Various news reports of the day said that 23-year-old William Brader had left his home in Marathon, Florida after an argument with his mother, and he was in Daytona Beach when he saw 15-year-old Pearl Kite, a runaway from North Carolina. Brader told police that they'd met on the beach and shared a 6-pack of beer and then started to have sex. But during the encounter, Brader said that Pearl went limp and he believed she was dead. He said he panicked and decided to make it look like a sexual assault. Her nude body was found 2 days later with her hands bound behind her, partially buried in the sand. Cops did a great job of tracking Brader down and he was charged with murder, but actually went to trial on the lesser charge of manslaughter. He took the stand in his own defense and was found not guilty. A news report said that after his acquittal, he returned back home to Marathon in November 1972. When I spoke with Greg Koltanak, who grew up in the Keys, he remembered that Brader had once worked at the Marathon movie theater.
Yeah, he did. He ran the machines. And he was a little older than all of us.
Could he have known Cindy and Terry? We were unable to locate any other details as to where Brader was in 1974, but we learned that he passed away in 2017 in Oregon at the age of 68. So let's take a look at some other leads that have come up in the case throughout the years. When a missing person report is made by police, it's entered into the National Crime Information Center, NCIC. The data includes all of the relevant information about the person, their physical description, birth date, social security number, and more. That way, police and medical examiners can make inquiries to see if a person they're dealing with matches an open case. Those records are also automatically searched from time to time to see if there's any matches or hits to other open records. It was around 1986 when Cindy Gooding's sister Diane gets a call from the FBI. They got a hit on Cindy's social security number. So, does this mean that Cindy was really just a runaway after all? Was she alive? And did they find her? Cindy's sister explains.
and the FBI is coming up to see me. I called my mother and she said, tell them the truth. And so the guy came and I talked to him and I told him.
Diane was 8 years old when Cindy disappeared, and their birth dates, though in different years, were just a day apart. One day she came across Cindy's documents.
Well, in my mother's little file cabinet was her birth certificate, her social security card, and she had never got her driver's license. So I took her birth certificate and I took her social security card back then and went right on down to DMV and got a driver's license under Cynthia Robin Goody, took the driving test. Got my driver's license, and I thought, well, we'll just see. And of course, my mother found out about it shortly after and took it from me.
Diane nervously explained to the FBI agent what she had done. She told me that the agent was very understanding.
And of course, I was thinking, I'm going to jail. And he told me, he said, I have some favors owed to me, and I understand. He said, but please don't do that anymore. Don't do anything like that anymore. I will never.
And then in 2010, during a routine search of missing persons records, police also got a hit on Terry Alfonso's social security number. The number in question was issued the year after Terry's disappearance. Could this be the break police were hoping for? The dates of birth were within months of each other, and both were from Florida. And according to police, the driver's license image was similar in appearance to age-progressed pictures of the missing Terry. But after an investigation, police were able to confirm she was not Terry Alfonso. There is no explanation given as to how two people could have the same social security number, but it's possible that Terry's number may have been misreported or misentered into NCIC. What are the odds of getting hits on the social security numbers of two missing girls and both hits lead nowhere? It's very strange. But that's not the only strange thing to happen in this case. In 2002, 28 years after Cindy and Terry went missing, sheriff's investigators received a peculiar letter from a man in Illinois we'll call Stephen. Both the letter and envelope had a sense of mystery to them, awkward handwriting, and a greeting that began with, "Howdy." The writer talked about Terry Alfonso specifically, asking detectives if there were any updated photographs of the missing girl and wanting to know if he could have one. Sheriff's detectives enlisted the assistance of police in Illinois, who brought the 57-year-old man into the police station for questioning. Stephen explained that he often visited the local library and said that he found Terry's case on a missing children's website. To investigators, he appeared to be a crime buff, and told how he wrote stories for a police magazine. His mother told detectives that Stephen had the maturity level of a 17-year-old. In the end, police said that Stephen was nothing more than a curious citizen with a desire to be helpful in his own way. Terry Alfonso's sister Darlene told me about another lead that came up in 2010.
The street that we lived on, 92nd Street, there was a lady that was gardening and started finding bones. They started digging, and they did find two bodies.
Police were called, and an intensive search began. A news report from NBC6 in Miami said that detectives found a skull, leg bone, and finger bones.
92nd Street. I have the paper right here. In the paper says, remains appear to be decades old, origin still unknown.
The families anxiously waited for results. The Monroe County Sheriff's Office would later say that lab testing indicated the bones dated back to 200 to 400 BC. Another dead end. And again, the case goes cold. But in the years following the disappearance of Terry and Cindy, and as forensic science has evolved, police were diligent in collecting DNA specimens from family members of both girls and others in the investigation, including the Crones, who we talked about in Part 3, and Cindy's former boyfriend, Little Dave. So, we've covered a lot of ground in the investigation, but what are we missing? Let's go back to some of the possible theories. As we've said, the families don't believe that the girls ran away, and neither do we. If the girls were abducted and killed, where are their bodies? Some people we spoke with, including Cherie McMillan Townsend, have their own theories.
Because it's easy to get rid of a body down in the Florida Keys. Take them out in a boat and that's it.
Former resident Sharon and her best friend Barb often thought that too.
That's why her and I have always talked about it over the years, how easy it would be for someone that was living on a boat or working a boat to take somebody out there and get rid of them.
Or could they have been buried? Terry Pease Cameron, the witness who saw the girls getting into a van, thinks so.
Actually, I really think they were murdered and buried somewhere along the way. I really think they're out there on that grassy key area. I truly do.
Well, she might not be the only one who believes that. So let's go back to Grassy Key for a minute. I'm not talking about that party at Joey Hatton's place, the one that Cindy Gooding's brother had invited the girls to. I'm talking about something else that happened out there. In December 1976, a little over 2 years after the girls went missing, it was reported that a hippie-type man was offering to show a human skeleton to campers on Grassy Key for a quarter, and someone reported the incident to police. The remains were found in an area called the Gaines Rock Pit, near mile marker 55.5 on US 1, about 4 miles north of Marathon. When Terry Alfonso's family learned of the discovery, it gave them a glimmer of hope, although bittersweet, that maybe they'd finally found Terry. Darlene read us the headline from an old newspaper clipping.
1976 murder of young woman still a mystery. They reconstructed the girl's head, but it doesn't say anything. So it's still a mystery. Yeah, the girl believed to have stood 5 feet 2 inches, 15 pounds, which was pretty much like Terry.
The skeleton was found lying face down about 50 feet from a rutted car path in a heavily wooded area. And according to an article in the Sun Sentinel, the remains were partially covered by leaves, vines, and Spanish moss. Another report indicated that the body was not readily visible from the nearest path. As police looked at various missing persons reports and checked them against the dental records of their Jane Doe, they found no matches. In 1987, Terry Alfonso's mother asked police to look into the possibility that the remains were her missing daughter. According to a police report, an anthropologist examined the remains and was able to exclude both Cindy and Terry as being the victim. So it wasn't our girls, but the question remained, who was the Jane Doe found on Grassy Key? In many cold cases, time is the enemy for investigators. But in this case, time and the advancements in science, in particular DNA science, would become their friend. According to the Sheriff's Department, it was in 2004 when a lab was able to isolate a DNA profile on the bones from Grassy Key, which matched Stephanie Semple, who'd been missing from Boca Raton, Florida since March 1976. It was reported that Stephanie was a chronic runaway, and she had told her mother she was going to the Florida Keys with friends. So even though the bones found on Grassy Key were finally identified, the cause of Stephanie Semple's death is still unknown. And the circumstances surrounding her discovery and the fact that she was found only 2 years after Cindy and Terry vanished caused concern for the families. Who was that hippie-type man showing a human skeleton to tourists in exchange for money? And why didn't he call police? Well, it was someone you've already heard about. According to police reports that Terry Alfonso's family shared with us, it was Little Dave's friend, Terry Freifogel, who discovered the remains on Grassy Key. He would have been 18 years old at the time the remains were found in 1976. I called Freifogel to ask him about the discovery, but he denied finding any remains, and he told me that any such report was disinformation. Now, what I'm about to tell you is disturbing and explicit. We discussed the details of what we found with the families of Terry Alfonso and Cindy Gooding before this episode was publicly released. So I want to take you back to part 3, where we mentioned a couple of police interviews with two people about this case. One of those interviews was with Little Dave, Cindy Gooding's boyfriend, and another was with Little Dave's friend, Terry Freifogel. Investigators interviewed Freifogel in 1997 about the last time he saw Cindy Gooding. He told police that he was with his father, Robert Freifogel, Little Dave, and Cindy Gooding at Indy's Inn on Duck Key. They'd been partying and were all intoxicated from drinking and drugs. He went on to say that they all returned to the Jerry Dale Motel, and that Cindy was so out of it that in order to dance with her, he had to hold her up. According to that report, he said that at some point, Little Dave had sex with Cindy. He went on to say that his own father, Robert Sr., also had sex with a sleeping Cindy, who woke up and who, in his own words, began to complain about what happened. In the report, Freifogel went on to say that the next morning, Cindy was asleep in the bed when the three men left to go to Miami. So he said that they returned to the Jerry Dale. And if you remember, the Jerry Dale is also where Terry Alfonso's sister, Darlene, was staying at the time. And that's where the girls had been staying, too. But we don't know the exact date or in which apartment unit this incident took place. When I asked Terry Freifogel if he remembered being at Indy's Inn with his father, Robert, and being one of the last people to see Cindy Gooding, according to a statement by Little Dave, he told me, "That's possible. We might have been dancing over there or something." But he said he didn't remember the name of the other missing girl. I asked him what condition Cindy was in that night. He told me she was probably in the same condition as everybody else, trashed. He explained to me that everyone was partying, telling me that back in those days, it was a perpetual party. So let's talk about Robert Freifogel Sr. He would have been 41 years old in 1974. The story we just heard about him having sex with a sleeping 16-year-old is disturbing. So I did some digging. I learned that in 1997, Robert Freifogel Sr. was in trouble with the law. I asked his son Terry Freifogel about the federal case against his father, but he declined to talk about it and told me I'd have to find out for myself. Well, the feds had an investigation into Robert Freifogel Sr. and the production of pornography using minors. Those allegations spanned a period from 1994 to 1996. Reports say he pled guilty to the main count, using persons under 18 to engage in sexually explicit conduct for the purpose of producing videotapes and photographs, which were distributed through the mail. He was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. So that certainly raises a concern when we go back to Robert Freifogel Sr. being seen in the company of Cindy both at Indy's Inn and at the Jerry Dale. I spoke with Greg Koltanak, who was a teenager in Marathon in the 70s. He remembered the Freifogel family, and he shared an experience he had as a teenager when he went to the Freifogel home and Robert Sr. answered the door.
And so Bob answered the door. "Come on in, though. Come on in." Again, and there's this girl, and she had a top off, and I'm going, "Whoa." And he's grabbing her, and he's got his hands all over. He says, "Man, she wants to fuck him." And I'm just a kid. My legs started shaking. I'm trying to figure a way out of this already. I'm leaving, you know? He talked me into it. Like, we go in the back room, taking my clothes off, and all of a sudden I hear the door, and he's opening, he's peeking in the door. And I'm going, "Oh, that's what this is. He wanted to watch, you know? I should have known better." That's the first time I realized there's something that really, really was something wrong. You know, to me, that was very creepy. I mean, we were just kids. We didn't even know what we were doing.
We appreciate Greg's candor in sharing his story. He also remembered a time after Robert Freifogel Sr. had moved away. He returned to Marathon after getting a settlement for a worksite injury.
I don't know why. He just came over to show off his car, but he had a brand new Camaro. I mean, he come pulling up. He opened up the trunk, and he had all these tapes. And he says, "I want to show you something." He said, "You got a VCR?" I go, "Well, yeah, actually, I do." And he had a little box. There was about 10 VCRs in it. He pulls the one out. He puts it in. And there's these kids going at it. He says, "Well, who the hell you think's taking the pictures?" And, you know, it kind of dawned on me. It was him, you know. And I was, "Okay, Bob, let's get it out of here." He just came over to show off his car and when he pulled out the video, I didn't like that.
So, given the background of Robert Freifogel Sr., and knowing that, according to reports, he was among some of the last people seen in the company of Cindy Gooding, where can we go for answers? We learn that little Dave has since died, and Robert Freifogel Sr. himself died in federal prison. Looking back, this has been one of the most perplexing cases we've ever covered. And as I said earlier, the story continued to evolve as we started receiving phone calls and tips. If you remember, at the end of part one, we asked that anyone with information about the trailer on 74th Street to please come forward. Well, someone did. Greg Koltanak, who you just heard from, had been living in a unit at the Jerrydale with a buddy who coincidentally was little Dave's stepbrother. In 1974, the two of them decided to rent that trailer on 74th Street.
Two of us. We didn't tell nobody. We were actually like thinking we could keep it a secret. That lasted about 5 minutes.
It wasn't long before everyone started hanging out at their trailer.
The clubhouse thing kind of, you know, I mean, they were all just kids. They had no place to go. You know, for as far as like the drugs thing, and it was weed. There was, you know, they were smoking weed, and it wasn't like we're doing it all the time, but just once in a while. But that's all it really was, just smoking weed and doing, you know, whatever we could find to do in Marathon. There was nothing.
I asked Greg about his memory of the night that the girls, Cindy and Terry, were at his trailer. Remember, Terry hadn't been in town that long, and Darlene said that she was at that trailer with Cindy and Terry.
I don't remember Darlene being there. I mean, there were some other people there, too.
But Greg's memory lines up with a lot of what Darlene told us previously. This was 50 years ago, so he's not able to put his finger on the day or date.
Yeah, you know, I can't sit there and swear that was it. But we were all going to go to the movie theater. There was nothing to do. Let's all go to the theater, hang out, and see. We didn't know it was playing or nothing. But there was literally, you know, no place to go. So we'd go to the movie theater and hang out and see who's going, who's doing what.
But at some point, Terry and Cindy decided to leave.
They didn't want to go. They left. I mean, there's only two ways to go. It's US-1. It was just two lanes. They just started going the other way, and they had left. Now, they were gone. But it was like dark. Nobody went out till it got dark. Nobody, you know, this is how it was when you're kids. You always waited until it got dark before you went and did anything, you know. But I remember that they went another way for some reason.
He thought that Cindy may have wanted to stay.
And she kind of wanted to hang because we figured we'd go in a movie theater because that's what you did, you know. But I remember that they, and it was the other girl that talked the Gooding girl into it.
I asked him if he knew anyone with a white van.
And then the guy next door, I think he was running for like Florida Carpet and Tile. That was a full white van, but it was newer. And there's one thing about carpet. It never could fit all the way. You couldn't close the door, you know? The carpet always kind of hung out the back, if you remember those days, you know? You know, they were good guys. They were older groups, so...
So now we have more answers about the mystery of who was at the trailer on the last night, or close to it, when the girls were last seen. And the van out front? We just don't know. There's at least 14 mentions of vans in varying colors that we found in our research. As I wrapped up my conversation with Greg, I asked him if he thought someone might come forward with information.
Let's give him a little time to think about it. And I guarantee you somebody's going to, you're opening this can. After this, if nothing else comes out of this, they ain't never going to get nothing out of it ever again. You're it.
We hope that answers will come, because it's been an agonizing wait for the families. Cindy's sister Diane told me that as a child, she was always told that her sister was a runaway. It seems that Cindy's mom had always held on to the hope that her daughter was still out there somewhere living her life. Diane didn't even know that Cindy was actually missing until she herself was an adult. And she never knew about Terry Alfonso and that she too was missing.
But I was led to believe the whole time she had run away, she will be back. I have letters that my mother wrote Cindy over the years and sent to Salvation Army, I believe. And they would try and get in touch and see if she was old enough, if she wanted contact or whatever. And then they would return the letters to my mother that they weren't able to find her.
As a teenager, Diane was always waiting, hoping that her big sister would come home.
So every birthday of hers, the day before my birthday, I would sit in the window and wait to see, was she going to come home? I still live in the same house that we lived in then. I had the very same phone number, you know, and I remember on her 18th birthday, I turned 10 the day after. And I remember thinking, she's 18 now, why didn't she come home? Then she's 21 now. Why didn't, as I sit in the window looking for her, why didn't she come home? You know, and I always thought she would come home. But when I was 18 is when I actually found out what truly happened. But when I knew the truth, that's when it really was hard. I honestly grieved her on my 30th birthday because I didn't have her. It's one thing that we were so close, I guess personality-wise or whatever you would want to call it. But it's another thing when that day is just a day of thinking and wishing. My 50th birthday. God, what would my sister be doing?
Their families have been waiting for half a century to find out what happened to these two beautiful girls. They've worked with a number of detectives over the years, and they've done their own investigating. And they have theories. Diane told me what she thinks happened.
Someone obviously picked them up. They obviously had bad intentions. Terry at 12 years old would not have ran. And Darlene told me her purse was at the house. She didn't run away. My sister would have had no reason to run away at that time. Something happened. What happened? I don't know if we ever will know. I don't see it as something easy. I don't know Terry's personality, but I know she's from a large family. If you are in a large family, you learn to take care of yourself. I can't imagine. Was something involved? Were drugs involved and the girls died or something happened or they were taken advantage of and easily killed? I don't know. I don't know. And sometimes I honestly think, is it better not to know? But it was something happened that was very vile against two young girls.
Cindy's brother agrees.
Something had to happen bad for both of them to disappear at the same time, same place, same party.
But knowing what happened would not give him closure.
Three years survived, but I don't think it'll do much good.
Terry Alfonso's sister, Darlene, has resigned herself to the belief that she'll never see her sister again, but she prays for answers.
I believe something not really ugly happened because Terry wouldn't have just left like that. Or Cindy. I mean, Cindy, yeah, her and David might have had an argument or breakup or whatever, but I don't think Cindy would have just left like that.
At this point, just knowing what happened or where they are would give her family some peace.
It would be, feel like we could breathe. And my mom, it would be a closure for her to know that. I think all of us pretty much know or think that they're gone, you know, that something happened because Terry wouldn't have just left like that.
Family members and police continue to look for information that might bring them closer to an answer. Cindy Gooding's little sister, Diane, hopes that if someone has information, they'll come forward.
Give it up. Talk about it, even if you think it's unimportant, because what you think is unimportant may be very important for someone to find an answer and have a way to close the door. How long can you carry something in your heart, whether it is truly important or not truly important. You don't know unless you pass it on. I would like to know what happened, but I also am a believer in God, and I believe He might know what you can and cannot handle emotionally. Could I handle it? Could Terry's family handle it? A 12-year-old? Seriously?
Terry Alfonso's nephew-in-law, Kevin, believes there's someone out there who knows what happened.
For the love of God, please come forward. If you know something, say something. Please, this family needs closure. There's somebody still alive today that knows something, and they're not divulging it. And they're not divulging it because they're scared. So to me personally, it would be a revelation. I know there's a lot of pain. And since I've been in this family, I've seen that pain firsthand, and it's real. It's in their eyes. You can't hide it. They want answers. I think it's always torn something. It tears a piece out of you if you're family. I can't imagine. I have daughters. I can't imagine ever something like this ever happening to one of them. But what it would mean would mean everything.
So what do we know? We have the confirmed date of September 3rd on the original missing person report, which is one day after Terry's sister Darlene said she saw the girls leave the trailer on 74th Street. But that date is then contradicted by Terry's own mother in a report made years later. She said her daughter went missing in August, not September. There was a confirmed sighting of Cindy on August 28th, so that narrows it down a bit further. But let's not get stuck on that date. Both of the girls' purses were found at Darlene's place at the Jerrydale. Did they leave them there at the beginning of the night, or was that their last stop before they disappeared? We have sightings at several locations. Some witnesses believe they were the last one to see the girls or talk with the girls. But depending on when each person first learned that the girls were actually missing, and the fact that there's a difference in dates, and by the time people were asked to recount their memories to police or relatives, there's a lot of opportunity for confusion. And there's many theories that have been raised over the years, including the possible involvement of known serial killers and predators. Some of them we've explored here. Some are debunked, some questionable, others in the realm of possibility. From everything we've seen, detectives did a lot of work on this case over the years and were responsive to the family's questions and concerns. They've spoken with a number of people, often traveling throughout Florida and to other states for interviews, and they've enlisted the assistance of outside police agencies for background information and to speak with potential witnesses who moved away but who might still shed light on the case. And for all of those theories that have been investigated and that we've discussed here, could one of those answer the question of what happened to Cindy and Terry? But because of the deep family ties both girls had, it seems very unlikely that they ran away. Even the families believe that they met with foul play. The one thing we do know for sure is that Cindy and Terry are missing, and their families and police want answers. We want to leave you with a song called Cindy Robin, written and performed by Cindy Gooding's brother Joe, who's since passed away. We'll post the lyrics in the show notes on our website. It's a loving tribute to two beautiful young girls who are missed by the families who love them.
There's a time in my life when I had to realize all the things I could be changed in just one night. Cindy Robin disappeared long ago, never to be seen again. Cindy Robin had no reasons to go. Is this how it should end?
In 1974, two young girls decided to hitchhike to a party somewhere in Marathon in the Florida Keys. My sister, Cindy Robin Gooding, and Terry Riggs, her friend, never arrived. And no one I know has seen or spoken to them since. Cindy was 16 and Terry 12. If they are alive, I pray they call home.
No, I've seen love pain, and I felt my share of misery. But the hardest pain of all is missing a girl named Cindy. Cindy Robin, where are you today? Are you able to be heard? Cindy Robin, won't you phone home today? Everybody misses you. Everybody misses you. Everybody misses you.
We all love you, Cindy.
If you have any information about the disappearance of 12-year-old Terry Alfonso or 16-year-old Cindy Gooding from Marathon, Florida in 1974, call Crime Stoppers at 866-471-TIPS or go to crimestoppers305.com or call 1-800-THE-LOST. If you or anyone you know is being abused or exploited, call your local police or the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children at 1-800-THE-LOST. We also have other contacts for victims on our resources page. Check out these links in our show notes, along with age-progressed images of Cindy and Terry, a who's who of the people mentioned in the episodes, a timeline, maps, and more on our website at apbcoldcase.com.
Thanks for listening to APB Cold Case. Tell us about your cold case at apbcoldcase@spawngroup.com. APB Cold Case is an original Spawn Group production.